Merhaba, Verhoş geldiniz. Hello and welcome to Talking Round North Cyprus, the only podcast dedicated to this wonderful little corner of the world where I have a holiday home and my co-host Roger Barra has a villa, an apartment and is living the dream. Not at all bit jealous, I have to say, but in a few days I am off for a week's break in the TRNC. So, Rog, looking forward to seeing me? Of course you are.
Hi there. Of course there are. I can't wait for you to buy me a glass of wine. Seriously, it'll be so good to see you in the flesh as opposed to being an image on my laptop like you are at this moment.
Yes, with the backdrop of my spare bedroom, yeah, and me complaining about the weather. I must admit, I'm looking forward to a little bit of warmth and a bit of sunshine because anybody that's in the UK at the moment or has seen the weather or the news about the UK, it's been pretty rubbish as we speak. It's pouring down. So, yeah, looking forward to getting there and even just for a week, getting a little bit of warmth.
I can guarantee you will get sunshine. We're still melting over here. It's still very humid. Very, very hot. It's what you expect, you know, and first week of August. You'll get the sunshine you're so craving for. That's a guarantee.
Good, good, good. Excellent. Well, looking forward to it and looking forward, obviously, to seeing you and Chrissy as well, which is the main thing. Now, you eventually caught up with our guest today, a man living in North Cyprus. He's achieved a lot in his lifetime, hasn't he?
Yes, an author, a journalist, a concert promoter, actor, film director and facilitator, but most of all, he's a damn good egg, you know, and someone, Sarah, and there's not that many in the world who has turned down the Beatles. We've been chatting to Peter Wills.
I said, I'll tell you what, how much are they? He said, oh, we want £100 because they've got to travel all the way up from Liverpool. I said, no. I said, my best band is Slade and I pay them £80. That's my limit. Then about 2 weeks later, they had their first hit.
Oh, dear. Dear me. I can't wait to hear your chat with him. Anyway, just before that, Rod, just some sort of news to catch up on. I see that Air Jeanne's new terminal's finally up and running.
Well, it's up. It's running most of the time. There's various stories coming out of people that have used the new terminal in the last couple of weeks. It's not totally finished yet. We didn't expect it to be. Some people have sailed through and said it's absolutely marvellous. Others have been complaining like mad on social media, saying it's just not good enough. It's not ready. The big problem, Sarah, was that President Erdogan was always going to officially open it eventually on the 20th of July. And as you know, that's a huge day in the TRNC calendar. It's their Peace and Freedom Day to mark the actual day back in 1974 where Turkey had to intervene to save their own people from genocide. The problem was trying to reach that date, and it isn't ready. There's still the retail outlets aren't finished. They're talking about still getting power cuts, and so there's a few teething problems, as you would expect. But yes, it is up, and it's almost running. Yeah,
up and almost running. That's the catchphrase, isn't it? Really. And just before we go on, I just wanted to mention if people caught our last podcast, and of course you can go back at any time and listen to any of our podcasts. But the one that we did previously was the lack of elderly care one. I caught up with Professor Hatice Jenkins just to really ask her how it had gone on the demonstration on the 26th of July. And she just messaged me back and said it was excellent. They walked from the health ministry to Prime Minister's office. They had supporters from 29 associations and they managed to deliver the message. She said there was a whole write-up, I think, in Cyprus Today. She's certainly been on local TV as well. I had a look at her Facebook page. She said that, you know, that it had certainly got a lot of notice. So that was good. I mean, I hope it makes a difference. That's what I said to her. Do you think it'll make a difference? Because they're looking for money to build new care homes and improve existing ones. Because as we found out in our episode, there are only 6 care homes in the whole of the TRNC and none are really fit for purpose and they're all full. So, you know, what would you do if you suddenly needed care and there wasn't anybody to look after you, particularly, you know, for expats? It can be a problem if you haven't got family or good friends around. So anyway, that seemed to go well. So we'll obviously keep in touch with her and hope that the government have listened.
Yes, there's an article as well in Cyprus Today that's published today on August the 5th, where the government's Labour and Social Security Minister visited the nursing home at Tini Rustru. That's the one that was closed because of the appalling conditions. It's been completely renovated. It's still undergoing renovation, and there's no sign to it being ready yet. And there's also, I'm finding it difficult to understand who's actually paying for this to be done, because the minister did say, you know, there's plenty of criticism, but no one is helping. So we'll have to see what happens there. But it's nowhere near ready to be reopened, although that particular nursing home is being renovated.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it, that Hatice was saying, that they want to make sure that in the next budget or whenever that comes around, that there is money in the system to move forward and get those repairs done and you know, contingency for new ones. So we'll keep on top of that. Lovely. So, Rog, as I say, you finally managed to meet Peter Wills. So tell us about your meeting with him.
Yes, Sarah. This is a chap who's been here in the TRNC for many years now, but he's done so much. He's met so many people during an amazing, diverse lifetime. It was difficult for me to know where to start. Now, his father was quite a mysterious person, as we're about to hear. So I started out by asking Peter if his father, with his love of music and theatre, was in any way an influence for Peter, who is well known over here in the TRNC for his choral, his pantomime and his theatrical appearances.
Well, I think it probably was, although it didn't appear so at the time. My father originally, who has a sort of spurious background we don't really know much about, started playing piano when he was quite young, and he grew up with his grandmother, who used to rap his knuckles until they bled to learn to play the piano. Then, obviously, war came and he joined up in there, and he became part of the entertainment team, as well as other things. And then he sort of advanced sufficiently to become a classical pianist. And again, we don't have a lot of information, but he played with one or two orchestras, predominantly in London, and eventually became musical director for a theatre. And the theatre company that was called Stolmos Empire Theatre Group, who at the time were probably the biggest theatre group in the whole of England. I mean, they owned about 30 or 40 theatres up and down the country. And he played sort of Blackpool, Seaside, he played, you know, Leeds, he played Edinburgh, etc. And eventually became chief musical director, in charge of all the other musical directors. So skip forward quite a few years. He asked me at one stage, would I like to learn to play the piano? And I very stupidly said no. But going forward again, he and I started producing pantomimes in the local village hall. And they were quite sort of professional affairs. I mean, we had good scenery. We had three or four people playing in the band, which he sort of wrote the music for, etc., etc. So I suppose, yes, there was an influence there. Although, in my mind at the time, that was not the direction I was going.
But he didn't carry on this pursuit in music, even though he got pretty high up, because his missus had something to do with it.
Yeah, eventually sort of I came along and she said, look, you're going to have to be here to help with the baby, and I don't want you travelling all around the country, so you need to get a job locally.
So he got a job as a conductor, but it wasn't the London Symphony Orchestra, was it?
No, it was the number 33 Wolverhampton Transport bus conductor. So he was still a conductor, but that was, again, I mean, we're talking sort of just after the war and what was available, and he was a conductor for many, many years, and then he actually moved into the administration side of the organisation.
Now, despite this kind of upbringing, you didn't go into the theatre at all. You became a journalist very early on.
Well, I'd always had an interest in writing. I mean, back at school, if they asked you to write 2 pages of A4, I wrote 10 pages of A4. I had a creative writing ability, if you like, and in my mind I had two jobs I wanted to do. One was to be a chef, but only on a train, and the other one was actually to be a journalist. And from the age of about 12, I think 11 or 12, I started doing jobs with the local evening paper, the Express and Star in Wolverhampton. And it used to be initially going in as copy boy. Now, for those who don't know, particularly a Saturday, football reporters are out commenting on the matches. There's a bevy of women sitting at typewriters, bashing away as the report is being sent over the phone. And the copy boy has to tear off the paragraph paper, take it to the sub-editors, who then edit it, and then he goes back and he tears another one off. Because normally, most evening papers produce the normal evening paper and the football special about 2 hours later. And so that's how I started. Then I progressed to actually doing copy-taking myself, followed by actually being asked to go out and do things. Because school holidays, I just spent all my time at the paper. And I used to sort of hassle them to say, can I do this, can I do that? And eventually they say, oh, go and do that cricket match, or go and do that football match, or whatever. And my biggest break was one Saturday when it was in the afternoon, all the reporters were off duty or gone home or whatever, and the call came into the papers saying that a body had been found at the local hospital outside in the grounds, the body of a nurse. So I got sent straight off down there to get the initial thing. They said, we'll get somebody else to come and relieve you, but can you get the initial thing and phone us in what's happened? And that was quite fortuitous in a way, because A, they let me carry on working with it, and then eventually court cases, and I was allowed to go with the reporters to the court. My school allowed me time off to do all that. So it was a good grounding. And, you know, right from the age of 16 when I left school, then I went straight to work on the newspaper.
During your journalistic career, I do note that you wrote for two magazines, and this sounds a bit like From Have I Got News For You. One was Knitwear and Stockings, and the other magazine was Corsetry and Underwear. How on earth does a bloke get to write for those two productions?
In progression of my career, I ended up working for a news and PR agency. I was based in Leicester, which, of course, is the centre of the hosiery industry. And yes, of course, we were commissioned by magazines to cover local stories. So I used to have to go regularly, sort of almost daily, to fashion shows and to speak to designers and creators and what have you. And the two main magazines I wrote for were Knitwear and Stockings and Corsetry and Underwear.
What did you write about?
Suspender belts. No, I mean, usually new ranges that were coming out. And obviously took photographs as well, which were presented as part of the articles for the magazines.
Have you kept up an interest in women's lingerie as a result?
Yes, I'm getting a bit too old for it though now. I certainly don't wear it.
In front of me, because obviously we can't go through everything you've done, because we'd be here for a couple of days, but in front of me I've got a book you've written called Name Dropper. Mm. Tell us about that, how it came about, and why you've done that.
Well, over the years I have met, and by met I mean worked with, a huge number of well-known TV, radio, film, music personalities in all sorts of guises, normally connected with work. Oh, four or five years back, I was sitting at home reading Dale Winton's autobiography. Most people have heard of Dale Winton. And I realised that his career path was very, very similar to my own, except that obviously he made it big in television eventually. But he started off as a newspaper reporter, he moved to local radio, etc., etc. Yeah. And he'd met a lot of people, and we had some visitors at the time, and as I was reading his book, I'd say, oh, I met him. Oh, I did so-and-so with her. Oh, fancy that, I would do that as well. And somebody reluctantly said, you should put it in a book. I said, well, nobody would be interested. My wife then went back to England for a six-week break at a Christmas. And I started jotting down the names of all the people. And I realised suddenly that I'd got 143 names of people that I'd actually interacted with.
Wow.
So I thought, well, how can I put this into a book? And I decided to make it almost a semi-autobiographical and base it on my career path and how I came into contact with these people. It had been bubbling up for quite a while, and I mean, I suddenly realised there's some quite funny and interesting accounts in there.
Because I'm sat next to somebody who actually turned down the Beatles, is that right?
It's true. Yeah, going way back to us, about sort of 15, 16, I used to run dances in the local village hall because there was nothing for the youth to do. Yeah. And I suppose, again, this was a little bit of the showbiz entrepreneurial side of me coming out. And I was booking bands, people like Slade, who were based in Wolverhampton, people like Rocking Berries, who were in Birmingham. And we're talking about Wolverhampton being where I organise it. And then one day, they were very successful. I used to get 300-400 people at a time. I even had to employ the local policeman to, in case there was any trouble. It was non-alcoholic, mind you. But he used to sit across in the pub over the road and said, "Give me a shout if you need me." But I got a call at home one day, my parents' home, from a man. He said, my name is Brian Epstein. I've got a band called The Beatles in Liverpool. Would you be interested in having them for your dances? And I said, Liverpool? I said, my people don't know anybody in Liverpool, and I've never heard of them. He said, they're going to be very big. He said, they're called The Beatles. They will draw a lot of people. I said, if the local people here have never heard of them, how are they going to draw people? I said, I'll tell you what, how much are they? He said, we want £100, because they've got to travel all the way up from Liverpool. I said, no. I said, my best band is Slade, and I pay them £80. That's my limit. And then about 2 weeks later, they had their first hit.
Your timing was a little bit off there.
Definitely.
Give us another couple of names that you've dropped into your book then.
One which is probably quite funny and sticks in my mind concerns Pat Phoenix, who used to play Elsie Tanner on Coronation Street. Most people will have heard of her. At the time, I was working for the Goodyear Tire Company, and for some reason or another, I don't know how it ever happened, we acquired a life-size mechanical elephant with a Ford 8 V8 engine to power it. And because I was in the marketing department, somehow or another, I got delegated the job of driving this elephant. And we used to transport it around the country on a caravan low loader. So you can imagine, as you're charging up the motorway with this bloody elephant on the back, the expressions of the people, how we didn't cause crashes, I do not know. And certainly when you went through Birmingham, which was very sort of, shall we say, Indian and Caribbean base, the faces on the people as they saw this elephant go by. But we took it to a fete where Elsie Tanner was going to officially declare the place open. And the press at the time thought it'd be rather good to have a picture of Elsie sitting up on the elephant. Well, you know Elsie, she always wear very, very tight skirts. So she had to hitch that up and climb up behind me onto the hoodah. I'm all dressed up in Indian costume, etc. We start going along. Well, you know how an elephant walks? It sort of goes very jauntily, if you like, along. And as we're doing this and she's sliding around, she said, "You'll have to stop it. I'm going to wet my knickers."
I could imagine Pat Phoenix saying that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we haven't got time to go through everything, but Name Dropper is the name of the book. How can people get a copy if they want?
OK, it was written predominantly as a sort of a semi-autobiographical one for family and friends, really, and to at least put down an account. The book is only available here in Cyprus. It was not written as a means of making great profits. If I can sell some and get my money back, great. But it's available in two places here. First of all, at Bestseller Bookstall at Karakum, and secondly, at Bookstall on Lambusa Market. Karen's Bookstall. Both have copies, so it's easily available there. If not, I mean, I'm on Facebook, I'm on all the usual multimedia things. If they put my name in, then they can find me and I can organise delivery of a copy or something.
When you retired, you decided to come to North Cyprus. Why? Why here?
Why here? By accident, actually. The whole idea of retiring was to go to somewhere where it was nice and warm and sunny, relax and do nothing. That was the plan. We'd been to various places, to Italy, to Spain, to South Cyprus, decided we liked South Cyprus very much. And I had some friends who had already moved there. Came to actual retirement time and thinking about what we were going to do, I was then working in my last job for two ladies who ran a multi-restaurant bar complex who had bought a property here in North Cyprus. And as their PA as well as marketing, I'd been dealing with lots of the correspondence and the paperwork and everything else. So I'd got a good flavour for it. Also discovered that prices had gone up in South Cyprus to such an extent it was no longer really viable. My bosses at the time had been here and said, look, you know, you can go out, two of you, for a meal with a bottle of wine for £12. And in our main restaurant, we were selling at £50 per person. So it was logical. So I decided, my wife and I, that we would come out on a recce. And we'd done some background work researching. We'd made appointments to go and view properties. And in our mind, we were convinced we were going to get an apartment. And the centre of Gournay appeared to be the best bet. And lo and behold, we actually found exactly what we were looking for. And I'll cut a long, long story very short, it all fell through. At this stage, we hadn't been able to sell our house in England. So I came out by myself 2 days after I retired, having again made appointments, and had seen this property in Karşıyaka, which I, at the time, thought was too far away. But subsequently, it isn't too far away. And it was a villa. The price of the villa was better in some ways than the price of an apartment. And I thought, well, you're getting all that extra, plus your own swimming pool, etc., etc. I looked at it twice and bought it, and then said to my wife afterwards, we've got a house. And that was in the November. We moved here in the January.
So you retire to put your feet up, lie on the beach all day and relax, relax, relax. What went wrong?
Well, as I say, you can't keep an old dog down. I've always led an active life. I've always got involved in things. So gradually I sort of integrated into things, particularly expat things that were happening here.
Yeah.
But I'd had a strong interest in film. I'd done TV acting as extras and small parts. I'd done some film in England. I'd done location scouting. And when I got here, the first thing that impressed me was what a fantastic location for films. Started putting things together and thought, I've got to promote North Cyprus. Initially, with the help of the government and the tourism department, 13 years later, I'm still banging my head on a brick wall in that direction. And those who live here will understand why. But I decided to form a company, which was called North Cyprus Film Productions, to offer complete support services to any film or TV company coming into Cyprus. And that sort of took off reasonably well. Not fantastically well, because nobody really knew about North Cyprus. Most people don't realise that North Cyprus is divided. They just know it as Cyprus.
Yes.
The South has already got a fairly good stronghold in the film industry. So we're still in an embryo stage, you know, 13 years later.
It's a wonderful location, though, isn't it, North Cyprus, for film work? Because you've got everything. You've got mountains, you've got beach, you've got cities, you've got picturesque villages. It's got everything, isn't it?
It has. And the film doesn't have to be about North Cyprus, of course. The thing I've quoted to the government here quite regularly is the fact that the Isle of Man, which we all know is off the English coast between England and Ireland, and I'm going back a couple of years now for statistics, the income to the Isle of Man in, 2020, was £55 million. And that is purely income to the government because of film. None of the films are about the Isle of Man. They're about all sorts of things, but the locations are right. And this is what's good about North Cyprus. We could even do a Western. in the horse Cyprus, you know.
You could do with something like Bergerac did for Jersey, you know, which was prime time viewing for over a decade.
Oh, yes. There are so many opportunities here, but the film industry is a funny industry. Most countries will offer film companies a huge repayment of VAT, for example. Now, if you're shooting a film which is costing, say, £5 million, and you're paying, I'm just making it easy now, £500,000 in VAT, and they say, well, we'll give you 75% of that back. It's a good incentive to go to the country. And part of my planning and progress, if you like, with the government here is to say, look, here is an opportunity. I can guarantee the government will actually make 2.5-3 million TL in the first 2 years, plus all the business for the hotels, the restaurants, etc., etc., etc. It could be a very big industry. But unfortunately, the attitude is, and I mean, I love Noel Cyprus, don't get me wrong. The attitude is, oh, well, if it means doing some work, forget it.
So what does need to happen? Just, you know, government to really understand what's at stake and how it could benefit all?
Well, the biggest problem with our government is that it changes too often.
Yeah.
I used to do a lot of work with local authorities back in England, without going into detail. If the ruling party changed within a local or county council, the heads changed, but all the staff remained.
Yes.
Here, unfortunately, if you take, say, the Ministry of Tourism is an example, if the head changes, 50% of the staff change, so there is no continuity. And that's the way the system works here, and there's nothing we can do about it.
That's exactly what our last guest, Hattie J. Jenkins, said about elderly care.
Yes.
The health minister just is changing all the time, so yep. You get a rapport and then you lose it.
That's right. I mean, I've made strides forward on many occasions, even to the point with one tourism minister who I did a detailed report, and he was going to the council of ministers and saying, this is what I want to spend 300,000 on immediately. 2 weeks later, he was out. So this is the difficulty here. And I've decided at the moment, whilst I still have a website, I will still promote North Cyprus as a location, I will field any inquiries. But even the simple thing, like saying to the government, when you get a call from a TV company or a film company, who is going to answer that phone? Is there anybody that knows anything about the business? And the answer is no. So I said, what we need to do and you need to promote is a dedicated phone number, a dedicated email address, so that the person who's responding knows what they are talking about and can immediately respond. At the moment, you don't have that.
So what are you doing with yourself now? Because you haven't just written books, you've written a full-length feature film, is that right?
Yes. I love writing when I'm in the mood for it. I've started writing a second book, which again is really meant for family purposes.
Yes, sir.
It's again a semi-biographical based on my time from arriving here in Cyprus. And I have a friend actually who lives in Tenerife who did something similar, and he's ended up with a bestseller, so maybe. But no, I'm working here with a group of students of all sorts of nationalities, from Russian, from Rwandan to Jordanian to Saudi. And we've done two short films where, first of all, they wanted me to be an actor, to be a semi-retired old policeman. The second one, I played a sort of Simon Cowell entrepreneur type who was rather nasty. Are we saying Simon Cowell's nasty? And so I have actually written now one short film, which is a 30-minute film, which is a murder mystery. I've actually written a full 90-minute full-length feature film, which probably will never get made because it's the financing of it.
I mean, what are we talking about here?
Well, forget Hollywood. We are actually talking, we can actually make the film here for around about 1 million euros.
And that, which is peanuts.
Which is
it?
Peanuts. But it's finding 1 million euros. My short film, I'm actually going to be able to make for about between 5 and 8,000 TL. Because nobody will get paid. That's really for locations and props and things like that. and plenty of coffees.
But you're keeping yourself busy. You've just celebrated your 80th birthday, 80 years young. And to celebrate, you were going to jump off the top of a mountain. What was all that about?
Well, a few years back, my son and granddaughter came out, and they are sort of adrenaline junkies, and decided they'd like to do a paraglide off the mountains, and said how fantastic it was. And I thought, yes, I might like to do that. I'll wait until an appropriate time, and if I crash to the ground, well, all right, I've had a decent life. So it was all geared up 2 days after my 80th birthday, and we got up to the top of the mountains, got all geared up in all the kit, etc., etc. 2 minutes away from jumping, the cloud came in. And I mean, it came in thick and fast. And you couldn't see a thing. My daughter was down below on the landing site, and they were communicating with her and saying, what's it like down there? Is it clearing, etc.? And we waited an hour and it didn't clear. So we had to cancel the jump. We were literally 2 minutes away from
it. I was going to say, how did you feel about that? 2 minutes, the adrenaline must have been surging through you, and then for it to be cut like
devastated,
that.
Devastated, to be honest, and relieved, perhaps. But no, I do intend to do it. There's been a couple of reasons recently why not. We had the Turkish All-Stars performing, so there was no aerial activity. We had President Erdogan's visit, no activity. Unfortunately, I was then ill for a while. So, yeah, now I think I'll wait until perhaps September time when it's a little bit cooler, less chance of thick mist up on the mountains. We'll do it then.
Peter Will's chatting to me at the popular Driftwood restaurant and bar in Lapton. My thanks to the staff there for agreeing to turn the music down and helping facilitate the interview. But wow, Sarah, this man, you know, 80 years young, he doesn't stop, does he?
No, I know. I like when you said, you know, are you, so your retirement, how's it going? You know, you're sitting on the beach, and he's like, well, not really. Well, it's like most people, you know, a lot of people we've heard from in the TRNC, life has slowed down, but they volunteer, they look after dogs, they look after people, you know, they end up doing all sorts of things, don't they? And it's great because people have got so many skills, you know, you've got a lifetime of skills, and it seems a shame that you just then suddenly just stop using them because they're of use to everybody. And, well, you've done a bit of panto in your time, but maybe there's a TRNC panto in there somewhere.
I'll tell you what, I used to write and arrange the music for about 20 years in Jersey. It's just so much hard work. It really is. No, that's not for me anymore. That was a previous life. Incidentally, if you want to know more about Peter Wills, he does have a marvellous website. It's North Cyprus Film, all one word, northcyprusfilm.com. And if you want to contact him, you want a copy of your book, or you've got a spare million euros to help finance his feature film, do look at the website, and there are his contact details there.
All right, Rog, well, thank you very much indeed for going to a bar. That was good of you. And finding someone to chat to. That's your forte. Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you very much indeed as well for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. We're everywhere, really. We're on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Talking Round North Cyprus. We have an email address as well. That's trnc.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Sarah Palmer.
And I'm Roger Barr. And we both look forward to talking to you again very, very soon.